You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Eleven on the West Coast, 38 special singing, Second Chance. Last night, the Charlottesville City Council tried to get together, and they had a riot breakout. And they had protesters with a banner that says, "Blood on your hands, standing where the mayor and the council sit." Amazing. The city of Charlotte, I mean, they essentially had the council chamber taken over in this protest. They couldn't control a riot. They can't even control a council meeting. Charlottesville, man. Those hillbillies need to get their shit together. Joining me is somebody who doesn't need to get his shit together. Although maybe he does. I haven't been in the business of supervising for him for a few years. John Ubaldi, Master Guns. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning.
What did you think about the president's speech last night?
Well, it was different than we had in the last past 8 years. I mean, the one thing I did like, he never dictated how many troops he was going to send into Afghanistan. And there was speculation from national security experts that it was going to be about 4,000. But he said, "I'm not doing that." And he also said, "We're going to be there to win." He gave more of a South Asia strategy that we didn't have before.
What do you think about that?
Well, you needed to, because, I mean, you and I've been there. You can't solve Afghanistan without dealing with Pakistan. And Pakistan has played that duplicitous nature. Their ISI, which is their Inner Service Intelligence Directorate, they bankroll about almost all the insurgent groups there between the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Haqqani Network and others. So you're going to have to deal with that.
Okay. Just so everybody knows, he and I have not spoken. This is not rehearsed, okay? And what you're going to hear today is just from guys who fought there, just talking about what they know. Is Pakistan interested in Afghanistan being a stronger nation?
No, in my opinion, no. They use Afghanistan as their defense in depth. Their biggest push is defending themselves against India. They're using Afghanistan as a fallback position in case there's any kind of conflict with India. And they almost went nuclear with each other back in 1999 over the Kargil Pass area. So it's going to be interesting how Trump massaged that. But he did make one point, though, and I'm not sure what he meant by that. He said, "If Pakistan doesn't do what it needs to do, we will do it for them." He didn't use those words, but it was something like that. What does he mean by that? Is he going to bomb that sanctuary in that federally administered tribal area where all those insurgent groups are co-located?
Well, I'm not sure, because he didn't tip it, but I think not only there, but in Quetta. Right down in when I was in Helmand, that's where they went. They left the fighting season in Afghanistan, and they went back to reorganize in Quetta. And so, to me, he doesn't go into specifics, but Pakistan needs to be part of the solution, because it's the same situation when you couldn't pursue out of Vietnam into Laos or Cambodia guys you were fighting against, and they found sanctuary in those countries. That's bullshit. You can't fight a war like that. But to me, I want to get your thoughts. The thing that I most enjoyed about the speech was it was not over focused on the military.
No, it's not.
The diplomat, you and I know, there's only so much we can do. And then after that, you've got to have an economic piece and a diplomatic piece that have to be robust so that the Afghan people can look to the future with hope. And once they have economic hope, they tend not to want to pick up rifles. Your thoughts on what he said economically and also diplomatically?
Well, no, you're absolutely correct on that. Too often we focus on the counterterrorism piece, the military aspect. And one thing Trump did mention is he wants the Afghan government, you know, to take the lead to do things, because we can't do things for them that they don't want to do for themselves. And I know this image of nation building is really an anathema to most Americans, especially those in the national security thing. But you're going to have to focus on stability operations. You've got to get that Afghan government to focus itself down into the provincial level. And that's where the Taliban has made gains, because that Afghan government is corrupt and they don't have any money. They're 100% of their budget comes from foreign aid. So that's got to be addressed unless to be effective against the Taliban and to expand and make a more peaceful Afghanistan.
A lot of people describe then Afghanistan for people. I describe it as, it's a series of city states. You have Kabul, yeah, an area around Kabul. You have Kandahar, right? And the area around Kandahar. And those tend to be run by warlords that run the region and they run the city. And Afghanistan as a nation, they look at you and they're like, what? So when you're down in Helmand, which is in the south central part of the country, you mentioned Kabul, they're like, what? Kabul what? Yeah, we don't do that, man. For us,
no, you're
Lashkar
Gah, you're correct.
Lashkar Gah is the provincial capital. That's Kabul for us. Kandahar, what? We don't care about Kandahar. You know, people come.
I think what your listeners also need to know, Afghanistan is almost like two separate entities. You've got the Hindu Kush that splits Afghanistan in two. You've got the tribal, you know, the ethnic troops, the Hazaris, the Uzbek, Tajiks. They're more in the north. Once you cross over to the south, that's when you get the Pashtun stronghold. And Pashtun ethnic group crosses over into Pakistan. But there's different subsets of the Pashtun network. And then you've got that Pashtun Wali, the code of the Pashtuns that rules everything, that predates Islam. So it's a very tribal country. And you're right, what happens in Kandahar doesn't go into Lashkar Gah and vice versa.
So overall, do you think that speech pointed, and you and I have talked on this program before about phase four winning the peace. Did last night's speech, did it lay out a vision that is achievable with American power? And when I say American power, I don't mean military power. I mean economic, diplomatic, and military. Those three legs of the stool have got to play or it doesn't work. Did he do that well enough last night?
Well, I think he addressed the three legs. He mentioned, obviously, the military portion, but he did put a big emphasis on the diplomatic and the economic, and he wants to bring in the regional power of India. He mentioned Pakistan. We haven't heard anybody talk about it in a regional approach. But one thing he didn't mention, but you got to look at that, and I'm wondering if General Mattis, McMasters, and some of the national security staff thought about it. Where does Russia and China play in this? Because Russia is now sending some arms to the Taliban because they see influence in that area. So I think he did. I just got to see how he's going to push that forward, and do we have a staying power as we move forward?
Okay, what was the best part of the speech?
I think the best part of it is not anything he said, It's how he said it. Because you know, when he speaks on the domestic side, he speaks a different way. Now, it was still a Trump-esque speech, but he was blunt and serious in what he was trying to accomplish. And he never gave timelines. I think the best part of it for me, because when President Obama gave his West Point address about surging troops into Afghanistan, he said, we are going to surge this many troops. And then the next two sentences, he says, we're going to set a timeline. Trump didn't do that. He says, we're going to base this off conditions on the ground. We're not going to tell you troop numbers. We're not going to tell you exit strategy. And we're not going to tell you when and when we're going to hit you. We're going to do this at our time frame, and we're going to win. I think that was a difference that I've heard from President Trump.
So you felt good about that?
Yeah, and I like that approach. I mean, we need to be serious, and we need to also look at the American people. This isn't going to be easy. And I think the Bush administration, definitely the Obama administration, never did that. They never conveyed, why are we there? What do we have to do? And that's one thing Trump did do. He changed his calculus because last year during the campaign, he said, we got to pull out. This is wasting troops. This is wasting lives and money.
Right.
And then he said, listen, when I came in, I said one thing, but once I saw, once I read, once I asked questions from my national security experts, I realized the United States can't pull out. We saw what happened when we did that in Iraq in 2011. And the Taliban was able, not Taliban, the ISIS was able to fill the void.
My guest today from the Ubaldi Reports is John Ubaldi, and we're talking about the president's speech last night some breaking news from the Wall Street Journal. The United States has sanctioned Chinese and Russian firms for doing business with North Korea. So, film at 11. We're naturally talking about the president's speech. Overall, does it point the country in the right direction?
I think it does. It gives us clarity. I mean, Afghanistan, because President Obama was pulling troops out, and he was going to pull all troops out until he saw what happened in Iraq when we did that. So we kind of capped troop levels. This gives us a little bit renewed focus. He's unhandcuffed the military. But going back earlier, we've got more than just a military approach. We've got an economic. We've got diplomatic. So there's things that we need to do. It's just the question, what is our measure of success? And how do we define victory in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and South Asia?
All right, next question. There's a number of comments that were made about the rules of engagement last night. When you were in Afghanistan, was that a problem for you? Were the rules of engagement ever an issue for you? Because I can tell you what, I did that every day, and we never had an issue killing people that we needed to kill. I'm curious, and a lot of that stuff, in my opinion, was implemented after, I would say, inexperienced units overreacted, and there were civilian casualties that occurred. And so, but there was nothing that ever hamstrung me from defending Marines or soldiers when their lives were at stake. It did give us probably a little bit more restrained path, but that's not inappropriate in a counterinsurgency when it's appropriate. Like I said, when you're in danger, you can kill anybody you need to kill, you know. And I'll just give you an example. If Master Guns is on patrol and he calls in and he says, we have three wounded, all three are urgent, I need this compound leveled. If their lives are at risk, it doesn't matter how many civilians are in the compound. I can destroy that compound to save their lives. Okay, but if he, my earlier example, if he himself is in a compound and they're pinned in the compound by cruiser weapon fire and things like that, and I say, hey, Master Guns, have you taken any casualties? Negative. Are you going to take casualties if you stay put? Negative, sir. We're good here. We're just not moving. Got it. You sit tight. We're going to figure out what we can do relative to civilians in the area, and I'll get right back to you. And that's how you prosecute that stuff. Now, the reason that was done like that was because at some prior instance, somebody just leveled something, and you find out that these guys weren't really in imminent danger. Well, come on, we can be better than that. Because really, overall, we just made life harder for ourselves because we just killed a bunch of civilians, and now these people hate our guts. And so the hearts and minds things, yeah, that shit's out the window. And now they hate us, and they're not going to help.
Well, no, that's a good point, because the first time I was in Afghanistan was in 2002, and when an army unit went to an area, and they had some weapons fire went up in the air, and what they did is they came across a wedding party. And for your listeners, in Afghanistan, you shoot weapons up into the air. Well, they thought they were taking fire, and they called in an AC-130 gunship. Well, they freaking leveled the town, killed a bunch of civilians, and that makes it difficult for us to move forward. So you got to balance that off. I think people are misconstruing what our rules of engagement were. Even in World War II, there was rules of engagement. When we landed at D-Day, President Eisenhower said, hey, only destroy what you need to destroy to accomplish your mission. So we always have rules of engagement. They need to be looked at, adjusted, but right. I never felt constrained about protecting my Marines.
Right. No, and again, what it required is you had to educate, you know, people, and it does take a certain amount of experience because, I mean, getting shot at scares the shit out of you, right?
Oh, yes.
Right? And the other thing is it pisses you off. Like, are you fucking kidding me? Those guys are trying to kill us, right? So let's kill them. And I don't care how many of them there are. Let's kill them. Let's kill every one of them and chase them down, and we'll kill them too. Because you're pissed. And that's the normal reaction is you want to live and somebody's threatening your life. And so, you know, but it has to be managed because the violence that we can unleash is incredible, is honestly absolutely astounding, incredible in two ways. One, the speed at which it happens, and two, the lethality. Like, if we decide to hit you with a hellfire, we can physically hit you with the missile, right? Not just blow your shit up. I can have it flown into Master Gun's back. Ba-boom. Yeah, we ass shot one asshole. He's on his cell phone in the middle of the field, and he was a target, and we intercepted his signal and got a drone, right? He was standing there talking to the field, and as the missile was about to impact him, he bent over. He got hit right in the ass with the hellfire. And it was awesome. And but that's how accurate and lethal. And so when somebody gets killed, one of the hardest things you do is you have to restrain that. And I can hear staff NCOs saying to younger Marines, slow as pro, boys. All right, slow as pro, right? Keep it checked down, all right? We'll get these guys. Don't, you know, nobody lose their shit. Keep doing what we do. And that's the stuff, that's the steady hand that you need in combat. And if you lose that, and we're just going to go kill people, that's never a good thing.
Well, it's never a good thing. And then the terror organizations, they know that. That we do have restraint when it comes to civilians. That's why they put their stuff in a weapons cache. They fight behind civilians. The Israelis found that out when they went at it with Hamas in the Gaza Strip area. They put all their stuff in hospitals, schools, homes, so you destroy it, and they said, look at they're killing kids or killing women or children or whatever. So it's got to be balanced, and you got to be restrained because you don't want to create more of an enemy and animosity against, and especially in Afghanistan, they have a revulsion against outsiders.
The my guest is John Ubaldi. We're just talking about our our lives in Afghanistan and what we need. I thought probably the biggest speech was the biggest part of the speech was the focus on Pakistan and also broadening it to say, look, our military can go deal with this. We've done it before. But there's got to be something that in terms of economic development, in terms of diplomatic initiatives, that gets going. So once we create this environment where the Taliban is largely not around anymore, that economic growth can happen. And how do we stimulate this? Right? Well, in the Helmand Valley, you turn on the water so they can grow opium. What? Yeah, that's what they do. That there's a lot of money in opium, for those of you who don't know. Okay.
But it's also there's a cottage industry that supports that. If they don't grow that, let's say they grow vegetables, there may be an industry, there may be a market for that, may not. So you got to be careful how you do things, and you got to know the culture that you're getting into.
Okay, so when I had General Allen on, he said, Well, Mac. He's awesome. I goof on his voice, but well, Mac, pomegranates, would pay the farmer without him having to pay all these taxes that he has to pay to the Taliban, would pay them a similar price. And the grounds of Afghanistan are conducive to it. Okay. Well, how long does it take me to plant a pomegranate tree until it becomes a mature tree? 5 to 6 years. Okay, so we're going to guarantee that if you begin this program, we'll guarantee a level of income for a farmer, and that we'll guarantee the security of the region so that they can move out of opium into pomegranate. Yes? Well, that's a political decision. So there are those things out there, right? And we have the irrigation systems that USAID has built in the 50s. In the 60s, in Afghanistan, that's why all the poppy gets grown in Helmand, because USAID built a canal system that irrigates the shit out of that place.
Yeah, Helmand Dam, I think it was called.
Right, right.
Yeah, they built that in the 50s, in the early 60s.
The Kajaki
Dam, that's it.
Yeah, we did a whole bunch
Then the other aspect, which you mentioned, that it takes, let's say, 5 or 6 years for a pomegranate tree to mature, how much water does it take? Because a lot of the irrigation systems have been depleted or been destroyed by the Russians and then to the Taliban misuse. And then when we were building wells all over the place, we took the Helmand River Basin's drop, and all it put was more silt, and it destroyed a lot of the farmland.
Yeah. No, the silt in the canals is a big deal. But the farmers will tell you that. Like, hey, if you help us with this silt issue, it's going to free up water in the river. It's going to turn on all this irrigation, and this land that's not currently arable because it doesn't get water, will return to farmland. And so again, but the first step is cooling that place out, and we will. But right after that, You have to have USAID funded. You have the people in place to get those programs up and moving, because that's the Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. That's how you transition it. That's how you transition it into phase four, into winning the peace. And that's where we failed completely in both nations.
Well, no, it did. But the other aspect in Afghanistan is, why did the Taliban take hold? The average Afghan hates the Taliban, but the one thing the Taliban did do is they administered justice. I mean, granted, it was harsh, but it was quick. You had the Afghan governors down, and sometimes in the provinces, they had corrupt individuals. You had to pay people off. The Taliban just came in, boom, done. So that's another aspect beyond economics. You have to get governance and stability into these areas and make it effective as much as you can. That's the other approach that has to be done in any kind of stability operation. We can't do it for them.
Well,
we can assist that with our diplomatic and our economic, but it's got to be, you've got to get that governance down there deeper into that level.
Well, Tim Lynch, who's a former Marine, who worked, did private contractor work in Helmand while we were there, he would tell you that A lot of those people, the original appeal of the Taliban was that they weren't corrupt, and that the biggest thing they fight over in most of Afghanistan, which is agricultural, is land. Shocker. And the Taliban, they resolved land issues fairly, and so that's why they gained a toehold, because the federal government was viewed as corrupt. And that you could have a false claim on my land, but you'd win the claim if you had more money to pay off everybody. And the Taliban didn't play that game. They sat down and they looked at the deeds and all the rest of that stuff, and they adjudicated it in what the people believed was a fair manner. And so they took, the Taliban were perceived initially as more fair. And then what happened was, they got hijacked by their religious ideology. Bin Laden got there, and the Taliban, which was an alternative government to the federal government of Afghanistan, they got hijacked as well. And so, what was the original appeal of the Taliban? It was that they were perceived as being less corrupt than the federal government, and that's an issue.
And that is an issue, and that goes back to that governance piece. I was always thinking that, and I wrote a paper back on it, got it for my master, got published in the Small Wars Journal, but it was on Afghanistan. I think that what they should have done is flip the country. Never have a strong central government. That government should have been almost like they had from 1928 to 1973. You had a king or a leader. He would just be a mediator between the tribes and the ethnic group. The real power was down at the local level, almost like at the provincial level, the tribal level, much like our Articles of the Confederation was at the end of the Revolutionary War.
Right.
Central government, but the states were the real power brokers. They were closer to the people.
Right.
But, I mean, that ball has already been dribbled down and gone. But, I mean, you've got to get governance to what you just mentioned. The governance has to be able to work for the people in a fair, equitable manner, not be as corrupt. So the Taliban came in and fixed all that.
Give me let me switch gears with you. So overall, would you say the president pointed the nation in a better direction and at least gives us the opportunity of a positive outcome in Afghanistan?
I think he did, because he recalibrated what we were trying to do, and it's not just strictly a military component. The military can never, in any counterinsurgency, cannot be the sole lever. You got to use your diplomatic, your economic, your political, and take more of a South Asia. We never had a South Asia approach, because without the solves that Pakistan, you have to do something with Pakistan. There's no way around that.
Let me read you an email.
So I think we have a better direction or to move forward on this.
Right. No, and I think we do that, Mac. I think one of the most significant pieces of the program / speech last night was him at least alluding to some kind of political settlement that may include the Taliban. I thought that was huge.
No, that was. I think that's another aspect. But he was also realistic about it. I mean, the way we're doing now, he said it wasn't working. And I think it's he really took a different approach than President Obama did.
No.
He was just negotiating, just to say you're negotiating. You got to have some kind of negotiate through strength, not through weakness.
Well, and what he did though was I think the way he did it in the speech was he didn't overstate it, but he introduced it, as a possibility. But the way you make that happen is you're strong. And you begin to kill them in Afghanistan in great numbers, right? You make their life hell, and they know what's going to happen because we've done it to them before. And then beyond that, you begin to put pressure, and you begin to crush your ability to use their sanctuary, which has been Pakistan. And you tell Pakistan, look, we won't respect your border anymore. Okay, so you can either work with us, but if you decide to work against us, then we're going to lay the wood to them, and we don't care if they're inside your nation. We don't give a shit. And so then you, as you begin to create that vice, you then create the circumstances for a political solution. And if the Taliban comes to you and say, we're ready to negotiate now, okay, then let's negotiate.
But the other aspect, he left a lot of things ambiguous on purpose. And I believe this was James Mattis's direction. He never let everybody know how many troops we're sending. He never gave timetables because everything's going to be condition-based, and we're not going to dictate or let people know what we will or will not do or when we're going to attack. We're going to do it at our time and our choosing, not yours. So Pakistan and the Taliban and all these networks are like, well, what does he mean? What is he going to do? Because before you get timetables, they can just wait you out, in which they did.
My guest is John Ubaldi. Master Guns, tell everybody where they find your work.
You can go to Ubaldi Reports on the website, or you can go to Facebook and just type in Ubaldi Reports and you'll find me.
One more email and I'll let you go. Hey Mac, I do think the president gave one of the best speeches he's given as a president. He certainly came off presidential. And I think that including in his speech the treatment of Pakistan, the need for greater diplomacy, and also alluding to the Taliban and a possible political solution, I think those are all elements of pointing this thing in the right direction and about as good as it gets. As Master Guns just said, there is no military solution to an insurgency. But there can be elements of national power exerted to create long-lasting peace in a region that has conflict. And I think the president put them all on the table last night. I thought he did well. And as somebody who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, I think for the first time in a long time, we have hope in both places that there will be positive outcomes. There will be peace and stability in the long term for those places. And I cannot say enough good words about what Mattis, McMaster, Dunford, Kelly, and the rest of that team has all done. I, for a long time, was very depressed that we would go fight someplace and it would all be for naught. Our amputees, our guys with traumatic brain injuries, to say nothing of the families that grieve for the dead. All of that a fucking waste. I now, last night, got tears in my eyes, thinking that this would not be a waste and that we could someday point to the places we fought that would be strong, vibrant nations and point to that with pride. I didn't think that was going to happen. At least we've got a shot at it now. God bless him. God bless the Marines of the Blue Diamond that consulted on this and have helped point the nation towards a better direction. I honestly believe that this gives us the best chance in Afghanistan to be successful. We'll keep our fingers crossed and hope. I know hope's not a course of action, but it's all I have now. Thank you very much for the program you do. I've actually learned a lot about slavery from listening to the program, which I certainly did not expect. Enjoy Master Guns when he's on as well. All the best. Hey, anyway, your thoughts on that?
No, he's correct. We finally got a more detailed way forward in Afghanistan, and I think President Trump has a good foreign policy team, and the one person that directly I know wants this fixed would be General Kelly, because he lost his son there.
Right.
This is personal to him.
Well, and let me tell you, and it should not be lost on anybody. Kelly's sitting there, a Gold Star family, knowing that this course of action commits us to more Gold Star families. And you can imagine, But, you know, just as he and his family know, there's a cost to being a great nation. You know, and what you hope is you don't waste those lives. Right? And so hopefully at the end, and just that's what the email betrays, right? You wasted our valor. Like, who the fuck gave you the right to do that? Well, maybe that won't be the case now. So maybe that won't be the case. Maybe that won't be the case.
So we at least got a different way forward. So we just got to see how this plays out. But I'm confident that we got a good foreign policy team between Mattis, Kelly, General Dunford's Joint Chief, General Kelly, and Rex Tillerson too. I mean, he's more in the background, but he does an effective job of doing the diplomatic part.
No, they say the right. They say the right thing, and I've got an email for you. Max, certainly Banyan did not seem a fit for the guys that you're talking about. It seems like Mattis, Tillerson say the right things, compliment each other, and tend to do the right things. Both tend to be reserved in comment and more on doing. I think the president has a great team there. Your thoughts? Was O'Banion as out of place as he seemed?
Well, the thing with Steve Banyan is, I know he clashed with, I'm sure he probably clashed with General Kelly, but also with General McMaster. The difference is when McMaster came in and he runs the NSC, he's putting people who are putting the country first who are not ideologues. That's the problem we've had in subsequent administrations. They put ideologues in without putting people who know these regions and are going to think strategically and not think ideologically. So I think Banyan was definitely an odd fit and should never have been there. And I'm kind of glad he's out of the administration.
Now, I agree. Let me just tell you, I can't imagine. I think Kelly's head would explode. Okay, so we're going to have a knockdown, drag-out staff meeting about XYZ, right? Right. Okay, and then it didn't go Banyan's way, and all of a sudden all the shit starts floating in the newspaper, and it's Banyan? Wait a minute. We had this discussion. You lost. Okay? One team, one fight, though. This is the Trump administration. You're a part of it. You're expected to row in that direction. We don't expect you to leak, right, and stab us in the back when we're not looking and to personally go after whether it's Jared Kushner or H.R. McMaster or whoever else you don't like. That's bullshit. I mean, I can imagine Kelly's head exploding at that point.
Oh, I'm sure it did, and that's why he fired a lot of individuals who were on the NSC. One of them was Colonel Derek Harvey, who used to be out here at Tampa at University of South Florida. He worked for General Petraeus. He went to Banyan and gave him some briefs without General Kelly's knowledge. And General Kelly said, General McMaster's. He went behind General McMaster's back.
I read that shit. It's like, how crazy is that?
I mean, you should have known that as a colonel. You just don't do that.
Well, you know what? They do know it, but they don't care. They play this political game, and it's not the same as the life that we know, you know? And so to me, I think it's, first of all, up until, they announced where he was going to give a speech yesterday, and then when you knew it was at Fort Myer, in front of a military audience, he wasn't going there to announce, yeah, we're unasked in Afghanistan. But you didn't hear a leak about the speech? None of that. And I thought, well, that's odd. Nobody leaked the text of the speech.
Nobody leaked even the numbers. No one really leaked anything. And I think the leaks are going to stop because two things have happened. You got a professional as chief of staff and he even told his family, you go through me when you go talk to your dad. And you got the Attorney General Jeff Sessions going and looking at where all these leaks coming from. And you notice a lot of the leaks are stopping now. Because you got professionals who care about country over themselves.
Yeah, that's not politics, though. That's not the way we do it.
That's not the way we do it.
It's interesting. No, I thought Banyan to me belongs with Flynn. They're different guys. They're ideologues, And but more than that, they're loose cannons. Banyan's a, he's a media guy, and that's the game that he likes to play. So hey, go play that game. Governing is not campaigning. It takes different people. And so
it does.
And so you can. And so, but again, what the president's going to do today is he gives a speech, I think, to the American Legion tomorrow. But today he goes to Phoenix to talk about border issues and really speak to his base, right? Hey, this is what we're doing,
right,
and reassure him, because he's getting assaulted. Like, Banyan's gone. You're leaving us, right? And so it'll be curious to see what version of the president we see tonight.
It would be, but I think for me, for President Trump, if he can get the economy rolling again, if he can solve some of these issues that can make people's lives improve. I mean, I know people say the economy's improving, unemployment's low, but you go to small businesses across America, they're getting killed by a lot of the overregulation they had in the last 8 years. I mean, come on, we got to be better than a 2.1% economic growth.
Yeah, that's a fucking joke. Yeah. And people say, yeah,
that's
a, yeah. That's good for us. And let me tell you, all ships rise when the American economy is vibrant, right? When it throws off money and jobs like nothing else in the world because it's so powerful. So clear the decks, get the shit off the table, and get out of the way of business. Let it rip in the United States and make, let those jobs stay here. Right? And people say, oh, no, you can't do that. Bullshit, man. We are the greatest economy in the world. China's huge. India's huge, yeah. But the greatest economy for a variety of reasons is the United States. And look, they can have larger numbers in certain areas. We just have to be able to understand that, look, right, you want to pay for all these different programs, then get out of the way and let business do its things, because all boats rise. But I, for whatever reason.
So that's where Trump will be successful. If he can get that moving and get more small businesses coming into the economy than leaving. That's where you need to. That's 60% of all jobs in America is small business. Help them out, you help America.
All right. Any parting words from the Uvalde report today?
No, it's just reflecting on the Afghan talk or speech that the president gave, and the president's going to be in Phoenix talking about the border issues, but there's still some upcoming things with health care. Tax reform is coming down, hopefully down the pike. So there's a lot of things, a lot of challenges coming up.
All right. What's the number one challenge coming up?
I would say for two things. It's tax reform and health care reform, especially health care reform when November 1st is a new enrollment period and everybody's going to see a big increase in their health care premium.
Will the Republicans be able to get that done? They failed miserably.
Well, they did, but I think as time goes on, when people really start to feel the pain, they're going to start, the American public's going to force Washington to start moving on it, especially into the midterm. And this doesn't benefit either one party. They're going to be like, we want this fixed. I know the Democrats are pushing more a single-payer system. That's their approach from Bernie Sanders, Nancy Pelosi, and the Democratic, the DNC. They're going that direction, and I don't see single-payer working.
All right. All right, there he is, John Uvalde. You can find him at the Uvalde Reports on Facebook, the website, UvaldeReport.com. He is a retired Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant. And Master Gunzer, always appreciate the visit. Have a good day. Thanks.
Hey, always do. Enjoy your time out in California, and I'll enjoy the nice warm water out here in Florida.
Your sweaty swamp-ass existence in Tampa. All right. Have a good one.
All right. Take it easy, Mike.
There you go. John Uvalde. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.